Blog Talk Radio.
Praise and thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Afolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. We ask that you please support our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host on Wednesday nights, Dr. James Jones. You can find Manhood, Race, and Culture on Facebook, as well as on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, please support Arlie Gordon of Unity Design, doing great things in the Motor City. Please reach out to him at Arlie Gordon on Facebook as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. Also, please support Brother Laquay Jewell, The Gathering, and the creation of an all-African FUBU treasury that's going to help finance and, I guess, help build more self-sufficiency in our community amongst us. Please reach out to them at aaesociety.org, as well as on the World Wide Web at All African Empowerment Society, .org. So tonight we're going to have a listen in session, and we call them our listen and learn sessions. And tonight, specifically, we're going to deal with SNCC, or the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee. And tomorrow night, we're going to actually have a live discussion with Dr. James Jones, who is a black historian at Prairie View University. And we're looking forward to having that discussion just to compare some of the things that we are still going through as a community that have not changed, things that have changed, some of the contributions that SNCC was able to make, including the people that were taught their revolutionary principles through SNCC and the people who played background roles with SNCC. So please get out a pen and piece of paper. The first piece we're going to listen to is Brother Julian Bond in reference to SNCC and its history and how it was created. And then we're going to have a listening session on the entire history of SNCC. So please feel free to queue in if you'd like. We'll be monitoring the boards. But if not, just feel free to, again, take notes and ask questions tomorrow and bring the knowledge that you know in our live discussion tomorrow beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also would like to remind you to please support Sign of the Times via our PayPal account. And you can do that via our email at signothetimes19@gmail.com. Sign othetimes19@gmail.com. So if you'd like to reach out to us by phone, you can do that at 330-366-6838, 330-366-6838. You can reach out to me on Facebook as Queen Tahira, New Power Radio Network, Sign of the Times, The Blackboard, and several other groups and pages that we have going, including the Free Ohio Movement and the Free Alabama Movement. We cannot forget our confined brothers and sisters who have been subjected to mass incarceration and Jim Crowism, and forget that they need our help and support too, especially as we approach these horror day seasons. So thank you, everybody. This is Queen Tahira. Enjoy tonight's broadcast, and we'll see you live tomorrow night here on Sign of the Times. Black love.
We would be remiss today if we did note the death on Wednesday of Howard Zinn. I met him in the late 50s, when he was chair of the history department at Spelman College. As you know, he encouraged his students in the larger Atlanta University Center complex to confront the segregation system they saw in Atlanta. And when the sit-in mania hit Atlanta, his students and others were ready. He became an advisor to the embryonic Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he wrote the first book on SNCC called SNCC, The New Abolitionist. He lived a remarkable life as a scholar activist, and we're all in his debt today. And I'd also be remiss if I didn't repeat an announcement I made earlier in the morning about the upcoming 50th anniversary reunion conference of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to be held in Raleigh from April 16th to 18th of this year. Howard Zinn had agreed to be a speaker. And I'd finally be remiss if I didn't introduce two of my colleagues from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who are here today, Joan Browning from West Virginia, and Charles Sherrod from Albany, Georgia, who will speak to us tomorrow. Now, my remarks are entitled, What We Did. I want to begin with a quotation from Ella Baker. She said, strong people don't need strong leaders. We were strong people. We did strong things. And I want to talk about some of the things we did. This began for me as it did for many, many more. On February 4th, 1960, I was sitting in a cafe near my college campus in Atlanta, Georgia, a place where students went between or instead of classes, a student named Lonnie King approached me. He held up a copy of that day's Atlanta Daily World, Atlanta's daily black newspaper. The headline read, "Greensboro Students Sit In for Third Day." It told in exact detail how black college students from North Carolina A&T University in Greensboro had for the third day in a row entered a Woolworths department store and asked for service at the whites-only lunch counter. It described their demeanor, their dress, their determination to return the following day, and as many successive days as it took if they were not served. "Have you seen this?" he demanded. "Yes, I have," I replied. "What do you think about it?" he asked. "I think it's great," I said. "Don't you think it ought to happen here?" he asked. I said, "I'm sure it will happen here. Surely someone here will do it." And then to me, as it came to others in those early days of 1960, a query, an invitation, and a command, he said, "Why don't we make it happen here?" And before I could say, "What do you mean, we?" King, Joe Pierce, and I canvassed the cafe, talking to students, inviting them to discuss the Greensboro event and to duplicate it in Atlanta. The Atlanta student movement had begun. We formed an organization, we reconnoitered downtown lunch counters, and within a week, 77 of us had been arrested. In an early 1960s freedom song, the young people who joined together to create the Southern student movement were described in this way. You know, I debated with myself whether I should sing this. My wife said no. But I heard cries of yes. I just sing this one verse. It goes, "The time was 1960, the place the USA. February 1st became the history-making day. From Greensboro across the land, the news spread far and wide. As quietly and bravely, youth took a giant stride. Heed the call, Americans all, side by equal side. Brothers, sit in dignity. Sisters, sit in pride, in pride, in pride." Yeah, that's enough. Yeah. As a former President Jimmy Carter told SNCC worker Mary King, if you wanted to scare white people in Southwest Georgia, Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian leadership wouldn't do it. You only had to say one word, SNCC. As John F. Kennedy said, compared to Martin Luther King's SCLC, SNCC workers were real sons of bitches. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was founded in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1960 by Southern student protesters engaged in sit-in demonstrations against lunch counter segregation. Within a year, the organization evolved from a coordinating committee to a hands-on organization, helping local leadership in rural and small-town communities across the South, helping them participate in a variety of protests and political and economic organizing campaigns, setting SNCC apart from the civil rights mainstream of the 1960s. Its members, its youth, its independence enabled the organization to remain close to grassroots currents that rapidly escalated the Southern movement from sit-ins to freedom rides to voter drives to political organizing. By 1965, SNCC fielded the largest staff of any civil rights organization operating in the South. It had organized nonviolent direct action against segregated facilities and voter registration projects in Alabama, Arkansas, Maryland, Missouri, Louisiana, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Illinois, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Texas, and Mississippi. It had built two independent political parties. It had organized labor unions and agricultural co-ops. It gave the movement for women's liberation new energy. It inspired and trained the activists who began the New Left. It helped expand the limits of political debate within black America, and it broadened the focus of the civil rights movement. Unlike mainstream groups, which merely sought integration of blacks into the existing order, SNCC sought structural changes in American society itself. In 1960, the dominant organization fighting for civil rights was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Its preferred method was litigation, and it achieved its greatest victory in 1954 in Brown v. the Board of Education. The NAACP lobbied Congress and presidents to adopt anti-segregation measures. Its local branches were often the main civil rights outpost in many communities. The NAACP and many similar groups and many individuals fought against a tripartite system of racial domination which whites had solidified over time. Ironically, a consequence of the segregation system was the development of close-knit communities, communities of institutions, churches, schools, and organizations, which nurtured and encouraged the fight against white supremacy. The young people who began the 1960s Student Senate movement lived and learned among such institutions. The movement's goals were described to the Democratic Convention's Platform Committee in 1960 by SNCC's first chairman, Marion Barry, as seeking a community in which man can realize the full meaning of self, which demands open relationships with others. He declared Southern students wanted an end to racial discrimination in housing, education, employment, and voting. SNCC's goals were similarly broadly described by Executive Secretary James Forman in 1961 as working full-time against the whole value system of the country and by working toward revolution. In 1963, he described as a program of developing, building, and strengthening indigenous leadership, and by third SNCC Chairman John Lewis at the 1963 March on Washington as building a serious social revolution against American politics dominated by politicians who build their careers on immoral compromises and ally themselves with open forms of political, economic, and social exploitation. SNCC pioneered first-time races by blacks in the 1960s Deep South, added foreign policy demands to the black political agenda, and broadened the acceptable limits of political discourse. SNCC was in the vanguard in demonstrating that independent black politics could be successful. Its early attempts to use black candidates to raise issues where victory was unlikely expanded the political horizon. SNCC's development of independent political parties mirrored the philosophy that political form must follow function and that non-hierarchical organizations were essential to counter the growth of personality cults and self-reinforcing leadership. For much of its early history, SNCC battled against the fear, which kept Southern rural blacks from aggressively organizing and acting in their own behalf. It strengthened or built aggressive, locally led movements in the communities where it worked. While organizing grassroots voter registration drives, SNCC workers offered themselves as a protective barrier between private and state-sponsored terror and the local communities where they lived and worked. The rural South SNCC entered in 1961 had a long history of civil rights activism. In many instances, however, SNCC staffers were the first paid civil rights workers to base themselves in isolated rural communities, daring, as it was reported then, to take the message of freedom into areas where the bigger civil rights organizations feared to tread. SNCC workers were more numerous and less transient than those from other civil rights organizations, and their method of organization was different as well. The NAACP was outlawed in Alabama in 1956 and did not begin operating there again until 1964, although NAACP activists continued under other sponsorship. In 1962, the NAACP had one field secretary each in South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and a regional staff headquartered in Atlanta. One historian writes, SCLC had to adopt a strategy of hit and run, striking one target at a time. SCLC's willingness to run as well as to hit provoked consistent criticism from SNCC, which organized the same communities for years rather than months or weeks. SNCC mobilized, someone said. SNCC organized. By spring of 1963, SNCC had 11 staff members in Southwest Georgia and 20 staff with 6 offices in Mississippi. By August, SNCC had projects and a permanent staff in a dozen Mississippi communities in Selma, Alabama, Danville, Virginia, and Pine Bluff, Arkansas. There were 12 workers in the Atlanta headquarters, 60 field secretaries, and 121 full-time volunteers. Typically, SNCC began campaigns by researching the economic and political history of a target community. Field workers were supplied with detailed information on a community's economic and financial power structure, tracing corporate relations from local bankers and business leadership and a local white citizen council to the largest American banks and corporations. Other research provided the economic and political status of a state's black population. SNCC organizers spent their first weeks in a new community, meeting local leadership, formulating with them an action plan for more aggressive registration efforts, and recruiting new activists through informal conversation, painstaking house-to-house canvassing, and regular mass meetings. Registering rural Southern blacks, a SNCC worker wrote, would greatly liberate American politics as a whole. At the very least, these new voters would defeat the powerful, hidebound Southern Democrats who were holding the reins of Congress and the Senate on the basis of being elected year after year from districts where black citizens were denied the franchise. SNCC and other organizations fought white terror and helped create a willingness to risk danger to register to vote. By one estimate, a majority of the unregistered had at least been confronted with registration's challenge by 1965. SNCC's broader definition of the civil rights movement's purposes was obvious from its beginnings. At its founding conference in April 1960, SNCC Executive Committee member Charles Jones declared, "This movement will affect other areas beyond lunch counter services, such as politics and economics." A report from the founding conference concluded with a warning about America's false preoccupations in early 1960. It said, "Civil defense and economic power alone will not secure the continuation of democracy. Democracy itself demands the great intangible strength of the people, able to unite in a common endeavor because they are granted human dignity. This challenge cannot be met unless and until all Americans enjoy the full promise of our democratic heritage, first-class citizenship." Another recommendation noted, "Students have a natural claim to leadership in this project. They have pioneered in nonviolent direct action. Now we can show we understand the political implications of our movement that goes far beyond lunch counters. We're convinced of the necessity of all local areas joining in a campaign to secure the right to vote. No right is more basic to the American citizen, none more basic in a democracy." Within 4 months of these declarations, SNCC volunteer worker Robert Moses was planning a student staff voter registration project in all Black Mountain Bayou in the Mississippi Delta for the summer of 1961. Mississippi, the most resistant state, became a laboratory for SNCC's unique methods of organizing. SNCC's work began in southwest Mississippi in 1961, but when its workers were driven from the area by violence, state suppression, and federal indifference, the organization regrouped in Jackson and Mississippi's Delta counties in early 1962. Earlier in 1961, SNCC's Nashville affiliate had continued the Corps-sponsored freedom rides when Alabama violence threatened to bring them to a halt. After they were released from Parchman Penitentiary, many jail riders had joined the Macomb movement. Several became part of the organizing cadre for the Mississippi movement that followed. Unencumbered by allegiances to the National Democratic Party, which frequently constrained other older organizations, SNCC encouraged two black candidates to run for Congress. Bob Moses served as unofficial campaign manager. They ran to shake loose the fear among Mississippi blacks, and through their progressive platforms, gave their intended constituents an expanded notion of what meaning politics might have in their lives. They talked of matters which white Mississippi politicians had never dreamed of mentioning, ideas which resonate today. Legislation improving the school system, a broader plan of medical coverage, special training facilities to develop industrial skills among the great mass of Mississippians who lack these completely. To demonstrate, the disenfranchised Mississippi branch, Mississippi blacks, did want to register, did want to vote, SNCC mounted a Freedom Vote campaign in November 1963. Over 80,000 blacks cast mock votes in a mock election for governor and lieutenant governor. 100 northern white students worked in this campaign, attracting attention from the Department of Justice and the national media, as black registration workers had never done, paving the way for the Freedom Summer campaign of 1964. Freedom Summer brought almost 1,000 mostly white volunteers to Mississippi for the summer of 1964. They helped build the new political party SNCC had organized, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They registered voters. They staffed 28 freedom schools, intended by their designer, Charles Cobb, to provide an education which will make it possible for them to challenge the myths of our society, to perceive more clearly its realities, and to find alternatives and ultimately new directions for action. Over the next several years, SNCC-backed candidates for Congress ran in Albany, Georgia, Selma, Alabama, Danville, Virginia, and Enfield, North Carolina. SNCC helped candidates for Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Services boards in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina, and Mississippi. It aided school board candidates in Arkansas in 1965 and worked towards solving the economic problems of the Southern Negro by organizing the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union and Poor People's Corporation and mounting economic boycotts against discriminatory merchants. Among SNCC's contribution to electoral politics were the formation of two political parties and the conception and implementation of my successful campaigns for the Georgia State Legislature. The MFDP challenged the seating of the regular all-white delegation from Mississippi at the 1964 Democratic Convention, and in 1965 challenged the seatings of Mississippi's congressional delegation in Washington. The convention challenge ended in failure when pressures from President Lyndon Johnson erased promised support from party liberals. An offer was made and rejected of two convention seats to be filled by the National Party, not by the Freedom Democrats. As Fannie Lou Hamer famously declared, "We didn't come for no two seats, because all of us is tired." Each challenge served as an object lesson for strengthening black political independence, and the organizing and lobbying efforts for each laid the groundwork for congressional passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The MFDP served as a prototype for the model of black power advocated and popularized by Stokely Carmichael. In 1965, the McComb MFDP branch became the first black political organization to express opposition to the war in Vietnam. State MFDP officials not only refused to repudiate the McComb statement, they reprinted it in the state MFDP newsletter, giving it wider circulation and laying the groundwork for future black opponents of the war. The MFDP's legal efforts against white resistance to political equality proved important to black political efforts across the South. An MFDP-directed court suit resulted in the Supreme Court's landmark 1969 decision in Allen versus State Board of Elections, critical to continuing black political progress throughout the South. For the first time, rather than applying constitutional the Supreme Court recognized and applied the principle of minority vote dilution, that the black vote can be affected as much by dilution as by absolute prohibition on casting a ballot. But the MFDP wasn't the only organization SNCC helped to build, and not the only one that survived the demise of the parent. In 1964, SNCC encouraged a group of New York progressives and health professionals to form a group to provide health care to workers in the Freedom Summer Campaign. Most of them were veterans of past attempts to organize physicians to push for integration of the AMA's segregated Southern affiliates and of sporadic attempts to win support for national health insurance. They called their new organization the Medical Committee for Human Rights. Wherever there was a demonstration or confrontation, historian John Dittmer writes, be it at the Edmund Pettus Bridge outside Selma or on the Meredith March in the South, in Resurrection City with the Poor People's Campaign, at Columbia University during the Student Rebellion, in the streets of Chicago outside the Democratic National Convention, at Wounded Knee with the American Indian Movement, men and women in white coats and Red Cross armbands were on the scene providing medical presence and assistance to the people who were putting themselves at risk. Throughout it all, Dittmer writes, medical committee activists were in agreement that health care in the United States was inadequate, unjust, racist, and in need of major overhaul. Their members established free health clinics in inner cities, created the model for the Comprehensive Health Center. They campaigned for National Health Service that would provide quality health for everyone. They stimulated consumer participation in health affairs. They successfully pressured medical schools to add programs in family and community medicine and to admit more black and female students. Their lobbying directly influenced passage of health care legislation and implementation of federal programs. It was then on the creation of the model for Comprehensive Community Health Center that MCHR made the most important contribution to the well-being of impoverished Americans. By 2009, nearly 1,300 centers were providing primary care for more than 16 million Americans at 7,000 sites in urban and rurally medically underserved communities across the nation. The mid-1960s were a turning point in the Southern human rights struggle. The 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 accomplished the immediate goals of many in the civil rights movement. SNCC worker Cleveland Sellers wrote, when the federal government passed bills that supposedly supported black voting and outlawed public segregation, SNCC lost the initiative in these areas. Northern urban riots in the late 1960s made the nation and Southern civil rights workers aware that victories at lunch counters and ballot boxes meant little to blacks locked in northern ghettos. SNCC had long believed its work ought to be expanded to larger cities in the South and outside the region. Executive Committee minutes from December 1963 quote Foreman asserting, "SNCCers have to go into poor sections of large cities to work." My campaign for the Georgia House of Representatives was an attempt in 1965 to take the techniques SNCC had learned in the rural South to an urban setting and to carry forward SNCC's belief that grassroots politics could provide answers to problems faced by America's urban blacks. In keeping with SNCC's style, a platform was developed in consultation with the voters. The campaign supported a minimum wage of $2 an hour, repeal of the right to work law, and abolition of the death penalty. When the legislature twice rejected me, objecting to my support of SNCC's anti-war position, the resulting two campaigns gave SNCC a chance to successfully test its critique of American imperialism at the ballot box. Like the MFDP, the campaign enabled SNCC to provide a political voice to the politically impotent and inarticulate black poor. In 1966 in Alabama, SNCC helped to create a black political party called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, an independent political party which would prove to be a factor in Alabama politics for years to come. The party was formed in reaction to the racism of local and state Democratic parties. Like the MFDP, the new party was open to whites, but no whites in Lowndes County would participate in a black-dominated political effort. Concurrently with the organizing effort of the MFDP and the LCFO and the Bond Campaign, SNCC was reassessing its concentration on the South. At a retreat in May of 66, Ivanhoe Donaldson argued in favor of SNCC's replicating its successful Southern political organization efforts in the South, and the staff agreed. Donaldson and Robert Moses suggested that techniques learned in the Southern campaigns could be employed to ease SNCC's passage into Northern cities. Michael Thelwell proposed in 1966 that the organization, quote, move to the ghetto and organize those communities to control themselves. The organization must be attempted in northern and southern areas, as well as at the rural black belt of the South. Projects were established in Washington, D.C. to fight for home rule, in Columbus, Ohio, where a community foundation was organized, in New York City's Harlem, where SNCC workers organized early efforts at community control of public schools, in Los Angeles, where SNCC helped to monitor local police and joined an effort at creating a freedom city in black neighborhoods, in Chicago, where SNCC workers began to build an independent political party and demonstrate against segregated schools. In each of these cities, the Southern experiences of SNCC organizers informed their work. As SNCC chair, Marion Barry had written members of Congress in 1960 to urge immediate action to provide self-government to the voteless residents of our nation's capital, the District of Columbia. In February 1966, Barry, then director of SNCC's Washington office, announced the formation of the Free D.C. Movement. He wrote, "The premise is we want to organize black people for black power." Barry and the FDMCM conducted a special boycott of Washington merchants who did not support home rule. In New York, SNCC worker Bill Hall helped a Harlem group working for community control of Intermediate School No. 201 in fall of 1966. His work laid the groundwork for later successful protests for community control of schools throughout the city. In Los Angeles, SNCC worker Cliff Vaughs described his work as a manifestation of self-help, determination, and power for poor people. Just as its concern for social change had never been limited to the southern states alone, SNCC's concern for human rights had long extended beyond the borders of the United States. It had linked the fight of American blacks with the struggle for African independence from its very first public statements. At its founding statements, it announced its identification with the African liberation struggle. It said, "We identify with ourselves with the African struggle as a concern for all mankind." At their fall 1960 conference in Atlanta, a featured speaker was Alfonso Cucu, an Antioch College student and brother of Kenyan labor leader Tom Mboya. The mass meeting program said, "Okuku brings to our attention the great significance of the African struggle and its relationship to our fight." SNCC Chairman John Lewis told the March on Washington in 1963, "One man, one vote is the African cry. It must be ours." In December 1963, SNCC workers in Atlanta conferred with Kenya leader Oginga Odinga, and in September 1964, An 11-member SNCC delegation went to Guinea as guest of that country's president, Sekou Touré. Two members of the group toured Africa for a month after the Guinea trip. In October 1965, two SNCC workers represented the organization at the annual meeting of the Organization of African Unity in Ghana. SNCC's January 1966 anti-war statement charged the United States with being deceptive in claiming control for freedom of colored people in such countries as the Dominican Republic, the Congo, South Africa, and the United States itself. Singer Harry Belafonte organized a supportive reception at the United Nations with 15 African diplomats in early 1966. And in March 22, 1966, seven SNCC workers were arrested at the South African consulate in New York City, preceding by 20 years the Free South Africa movement that later saw hundreds arrested at the South African embassy in Washington. At a June 1967 staff meeting, SNCC declared itself a human rights organization dedicated to the liberation not only of black people in the United States, but of all oppressed people, especially those in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. SNCC's chair, Stokely Carmichael, visited Algeria, Syria, Egypt, Guinea, and Tanzania in mid-67. In November 67, Foreman testified for SNCC before the UN's Fourth Committee against American investment in South Africa. There are many, many reasons for the demise of this important organization. The current of nationalism, ever present in black America, widened at the end of the 1960s to become a rushing torrent which swept away the hopeful notion of black and white together that the decade's beginning had promised. SNCC's white staff members were asked to devote their energies to organizing in white communities. Some agreed, but many believed this action repudiated the movement's hopeful call to Americans all side by equal side. For many on the staff, both white and black, nearly a decade's worth of hard work at irregular subsistence-level pay, under an atmosphere of constant terror, interrupted by jailings, beatings, and official and private terror, proved to be too much. When measured by the legislative accomplishments of the 1964 Civil Rights and 1965 Voting Rights Act, SNCC's efforts were successful. But the failure of the Mississippi Democratic Party to gain recognition at Atlantic City predicted the coming collapse of support from white liberals. The murders of four schoolgirls in Birmingham, Medgar Evers in Jackson in 1963, civil rights workers and others in Mississippi in 1964, Martin Luther King in 1968, argued that violence was no antidote to a violent, that nonviolence was no antidote to a violent society. The outbreak of urban violence at the decade's end further produced a sense of frustration and alienation in many SNCC veterans. Throughout its brief history, SNCC insisted on group-centered leadership and community-based politics. It made clear the connection between economic power and racial oppression. It refused to define racism as solely Southern, to describe racial inequality as caused by irrational prejudice alone, or to limit the struggle solely to guaranteeing legal equality. It challenged American imperialism while mainstream civil rights organizations were silent or curried favor with President Johnson, condemning SNCC's linkage of domestic poverty and racism with overseas adventurism. SNCC refused to apply political tests to its membership or supporters, opposing the red baiting which other organizations and leaders endorsed or condoned. It created an atmosphere of expectation and anticipation among the people with whom it worked, trusting them to make decisions about their own lives. It widened the definition of politics beyond campaigns and elections. For SNCC, politics encompassed not only electoral races, but also organizing political parties, labor unions, producer co-ops, and alternative schools. It initially sought to liberalize Southern politics by organizing and enfranchising blacks. One proof of its success was the increase in black elected officials in the Southern states from 72 in 1965 to 388 in 1968. But it also sought to liberalize the ends of political participation by enlarging the issues of political debate to include the economic and foreign policy concerns of American blacks. SNCC's articulation and advocacy of black power redefined the relationship between black Americans and white power. No longer would political equity be considered a privilege. It had become a right. One SNCC legacy is the destruction of the psychological shackles which had kept black Southerners in physical and mental peonage. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee helped to break these chains forever. It demonstrated that ordinary women and men, young and old, could perform extraordinary tasks. They did so then and can do so again. What began 50 years ago is not just history. It was part of a mighty movement that started many years before that and continues on to this day, ordinary women, ordinary men, proving they can perform extraordinary tasks in the pursuit of freedom. Thank you.
And the anti-Saloon League in American history.
The way for us to really proceed is we have a set date on April 16th to involve as many people as possible in training of nonviolent activities and encouraging engagement, civic-oriented organizations that are on an empowering nation. I want to welcome all of you, and I want the letter that I sent out to look. This is not a meeting to discuss whether or not it's done. This is a meeting to discuss how we make this meeting. I'd like to call on Liz to try to share her ideas with us about this resource and communication.
Yeah, so thank you so much for
pulling
this together. You know, it's been quite an exciting year, I think, for all of us who believe in the tool of the power of change, of people rising up and creating a line in the sand, which all of you in the legacy of what happened decades ago experienced and saw the impact of it now. And in the last year, starting in a lot of respects from Wisconsin, of workers rising up and saying, we will not make this, all the way to the beginning of events in New York, and then they're taking off, is that people really are in a place where they are starting to say, we believe that we need the tools to be able to create the lines of the sand about the stuff that affects us on a daily basis. And probably the reason I think that we got to this place is that we all know people are hurting, right? Like, our communities are hurting, our schools are hurting, and that it's those conditions of people really feeling the kind of impact of everyday issues on their lives, it's often their normal when they feel called to step up and to be courageous and to take on our direct action. And there's a whole set of people who have been watching this for the last year, really watching the real courageous eruption of nonviolent direct action coming around this country in the formative movement that erupted. And we're asking the question of how do we expand that moment? How do we give these tools to people in communities who are fighting on a variety of issues, where they're working on trying to get a local school board to really deal with an issue that they care about, where they're trying to really confront the banks that are trying to foreclose on homes and communities, or they're looking at confronting politicians who really haven't been standing up to the things that they care about. There's obviously, I think, some of all of us that have been watching make really horrific comments over the last 2 weeks on a variety of issues. And what could we do in this moment to really give people the tools and the inspiration to take action? And to take action in the spirit and history of living their own life and of the suffering. The mini movements, especially the civil rights movement, that have used nonviolent direct action to create real tangible change about the issues that affect them on a daily basis. So we set about to try and actually say, can we train 100,000 people in 1 week in the tools of nonviolent direct action, as well as start to create a shared understanding about the impact of the economy and what does it mean to be part of the 99% versus the 1% it's having on people, and that we're all in this together. So that is in fact happening. It is an amazing, beautiful thing that a lot of organizations and individuals are leaning in because they know this is the right set of tools of a reemergence of using nonviolent drug action on a big scale this spring to really address the changes and the issues that people care about across the board, and wanting to do it in the spirit and integrity and courageousness that comes out of everything all of you did at another moment in history, and figuring out ways to really get you guys engaged as possible is really critical, I think, to the success of it. I also think it's a moment about sharing those skills with the youth of today, as well as people who have been involved in who haven't been involved yet in standing up and to drive on and withstand. The basic idea is 300,000 people in one single week in April. So all we're doing is that organizations and individuals have been agreeing across the country now in 500 locations to host training in person. And we are continuing to find places and cities where people and organizations are saying, yes, we can set the room and we can help recruit people to show up to take the seminar training in nonviolent interaction and the tools of the economy. So that's one of the major pieces, and it's been amazing to see how many people are stepping up into that, and we're still looking for people who are willing to host their training. We're also going to be training 1,100 trainers to give the training across the country. And we're training them in a series of 15 training trainers, March 24th and 25th, at 15 locations around the country. Each one of those locations will be training about 100 trainers to go out and then run the training serving across the country. And then we're, in addition, and those trainings will range from 25 people in a room all the way up to 300 or 400 in union halls across the country. In addition to that, we are making a version of this people are going to be able to go online, which is quite a different era where it's possible. That wasn't even possible a few years ago. And so really creating a set of assets that allows someone to have maybe them and their family in their living room actually going for a training. If they're not close enough to learn the in-person trainings to get there. And then coming out of it, the real goal is to get people to tools and then funnel them quite quickly into action. But instead of acting on one or two campaigns, really action on a variety of different campaigns in local communities across the country that are set up to create these lines in the sand and saying, no, the banks can't come in and take homes in their communities. And no, we're not willing to allow the youth that we know to have walked into college and have now hundreds of thousands of dollars in money if not have the possibility of the kind of employment that they were promised in beginning of their educational career. And no, we do want to give people the tools to be able to stand on a local level on issues that might be very particular to the community and may not be a national issue, but might have real impact on our people's lives in that town. So really using the trainings to kick off a spring and summer of action is using nonviolent interaction to concrete tangible change on a variety of different issues that really are affecting people. So I want to stop there before I go on and get a sense of what questions people have already coming up. Because I know it's a lot to digest. The co-coordinator of this bigger project sometimes it's hard for me to follow this street because a lot of there's many moving pieces and the short of the time period is a little dizzying.
One of the assumptions I'm operating under, and I hope we all operating under, is consistent with what we just heard, is that we're promoting empowerment with local control of the activities. It won't be a group that sits down and says, okay, here are the four areas we're operating in. Our objective is to get as many people in motion as possible. You all agreed on that?
Yes. I agree. But one other thing I think that we should focus on is the group at the Suspended Travel.
Yes.
The group in Davis, University of California, Davis.
Uh-huh.
And how those students narrowed this set non-violently and sprayed with pepper spray. So they left the dogs, and they left the horses, and they went with pepper spray. And I think that those people need to know that we are behind them. And I think that that would be a great point to start here in California, at least.
Well, let's be clear.
Yeah, I mean,
as far as I'm concerned, the natural, I think that's excellent. But I think that the natural hookup, our first people that we go to, are those who participated in the Freedom Rides, those who participated in the Summer Project, those who we know how to organize, and how do we get them in connection with the
empowerment movement in their vicinity. I think that's too much talent to write off. And if someone disagrees with that, because I'm not interested in who are the most credentialed organizers, but who are the most proficient organizers based on their ability to communicate both nonviolence and the ability to really organize.
I concern the email I got from a Christina Sinclair under 99 Spring at NewOrganizer.com. Presumably that's the same group of whom we're talking about that's organizing these training sessions.
Yes. That means that you probably signed up to be one of the trainers because Christina is sending out email to all the people who signed up and are interested in being a trainer this morning.
Yeah. Okay. I got this a couple of days ago, but in Boston, I haven't received any indication of where the training is going to take place. And I do know that a lot of the schools up here are going on spring. In midterm, there are a number of students at Boston University and I've been present at events for them. We're going to need to be contacted, and I can't contact them if they're not in school.
What I would say is that most of the locations are locking down their locations in the next week or so. Because the actual training, not the training for trainers, which are two separate things, the actual trainings are April 9th through the 15th. Organizers are figuring out what the right church year or union hall or event space over the next week. So therefore, this is going to be the time and exact location of each one of the will be figured out over the next week or so, and then on before the event. And there's a whole lot of people trying to set up for the college to figure out. But I think brainstorming ways that all of us, in addition to be looking at how do we mobilize amongst the people that we know that they know about the training, that they know about the opportunity to the trainers, they can get folks to get trained.
Okay, somebody grab a speakerphone. Do you have somebody to grab a speakerphone?
Sure.
Yes, I have a question.
One thing I'm into with
young students, their buttons need to be pushed to get out and do it because they're just not sure at this point. Because they've incurred so much debt and they're worried about losing what they've earned by going to college, knowing that they could end up in the position of many people like yourself and others and myself, took off in the middle of school to do what needed to be done. And they needed to make a commitment at this point. It can't wait very much longer.
I couldn't agree more, and it makes it very clear that we must work together on this, on selling those who need to be sold and getting those in motion who need less. We need as many people in motion and in support of this as quickly as possible. Now, on the question of the students not being available, we just have to find places other than colleges, and we have to notify them as soon as we find locations. I don't know of any other way to approach that, but I think this is an opportunity that is fleeting. It's not going to be with us long. It is open to as many people as possible, around as many interests as possible, and there is no attempt to make the mistakes of saying, we've come in to offer y'all leadership. We've come in to offer y'all coalition. And there's a difference.
Can the people who just joined identify themselves and then also those people who are at a noisy place on speakerphone, please get off or go mute until you want to speak.
The
The Mississippi veteran.
Super quick, from Rogers. I don't have time to, it's not that I don't have time. I'm doing a two-day Kenyan Avalanche training on the day of the Trainer on Trainers program for what you guys are offering.
Yes.
And I'm working with a group of folks who are trained in, I would say, a form of nonviolence under Dr. Lafayette. Junior, which I think many of you are familiar with.
Bernard Lafayette, of course.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Bernard. Now, is there any way that we could participate, given the curriculum that we use? Because many of us may be able to participate in that TOT, or maybe it might be too late. But I know that we were already planning on doing a month of nonviolence workshops to honor April 4th, the assassination of Dr. King. So I'm just wondering about those of us who won't have time to go, or excuse me, our schedules do not permit us to participate in the TOT.
Thank you.
We'd like to participate in the trainings during the night, the 15th.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm really excited to hear how much work you're doing on spreading the message and the tools of the knowledge reduction. One thing that we're doing for this training is that we're really trying to guarantee that everybody, no matter what room they show up in, get the same curriculum so that people create a sense of shared understanding of the tools. So we are asking that the trainers specifically have gone for the training for trainers. That allows us to give assurance to all the organizations that we're doing the recruiting that the rooms won't vary. Their understanding was that if their folks show up in Cleveland and their folks show up in Cleveland in Boston, it was the same training.
I understand that completely. So those that...
But there's another opportunity. Yeah, there's another opportunity to be engaged. Yeah. Okay. I think that we should work on other ways to get you guys engaged or to look at if there's a couple of your folks who could go to the training for trainers. And figure out the ways that to get you engaged in doing hosting and training, even if it isn't as the lead trainer in the room.
I think we also have to do
And then I was also going to say is that there's going to be a bunch of these places that this is really meant to be the first training they've ever had in this stuff. And one of the resources I'm really trying to gather are the folks like you who are out there doing additional nonviolence or action training, and especially for the disobedience trainings, which are quite specific in a different case scenario, to make sure that we can give people the resources in the context of the follow-up trainings that we're hoping that as they start to get into nonviolent direct action,
right,
as many of us have, we know that you don't take one training and then you spend a life working on it, and that hopefully a number of these places are going to look at like 201, 301, and 401 version, and then also look to work with you on figuring out ways to look at you guys as a resource to be giving to the places who get so inspired through this that they really want to know more.
One of the things we got to be careful of, we can't be rigid in a program that requires and demands flexibility. If somebody says to me, I work with Bernard Lafayette on nonviolence, we don't have to say anything else. The question is, how do we bring them in, not how do we fit them in our schedule?
Exactly.
So this is about facilitating coalition, shared response, and if we have to make some date changes, we make them. But I don't want this gentleman to leave the conference saying, well, there's nothing for us to do. I want us to be committed to making sure that we find something that he agreed, he and Bernard agree with, fits into this operation. I want to bring everybody in. Again, if they want to work themselves out, that's their chance.
Liz, can you accommodate that?
Well, yeah, that's what I was trying to point out is I think there's plenty of opportunities for a number of the additional pieces, especially the life loss trainings and some of the other pieces. So, I'd love to work with them all trying to figure out ways to plug in with folks, even though they might not be able to go to their training for trainers.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and if
was that, is that Jim Marshall or Jonathan Lewis who was talking just now?
Jonathan Lewis.
Jonathan Lewis.
Who's Jonathan?
Then, yeah, good, Jonathan. Then can you email me your contact information so we can work this out offline?
Yeah, what is your email address?
RonCarver100@gmail.com.
Ron Carver?
Ron,
excuse me. I'm sorry to break here. This is Connie Curry in Atlanta. And I'm sorry I'm late. I just want to say hello to everybody.
Hello, Connie.
Hello, Connie.
Hey, Connie. Hey. Okay, sorry.
The Veterans and Civil Rights Movement in Mississippi is meeting from the March 21 through 24. We need to find out where other meetings of a similar nature happening, and who can we get to those meetings. That should be fertile ground for recruiting if we go in with a program that is indigenous, empowerment, and non-authoritarian. Hello? Let the church say amen.
Hello?
Yeah? Who's your?
Well, yeah, this is Connie. Cynthia would know. About getting people to the meeting, wouldn't she?
Well, my concern is, I want the people in the conference call to think about that meeting. Yes, Connie, that's the way to get that answer. I know that. I want the group start thinking about where the meetings like that happening in the country that we can utilize. And we should. And we should be as quick and as inclusionary as possible.
Okay.
Also, besides giving people my contact there, if there are people both on this call and who wrote back to me after we got the notice to dozens and dozens of people around the country, so they couldn't make the call, they want to be involved. What do we say to them? Who should they be contacting?
So, we can certainly send out my email address with any additional questions, thoughts, ideas, say people that you think that we should also be reaching out to. And it's Liz Butler, R-I-Z-B-U-T-L-E-R, D-C, as in District Columbia, @gmail.com. And then the other thing is the website for the 99 Spring is the99spring.com. And numbers not spelled out. It has a lot of the information. It has the letter. It has places where people can register events. It has information about what it means to be an organizational partner, a trainer, a lot of the information and ways that people can plug themselves in on that website.
Could you remind me of that again?
Yeah, it's the99spring.com.
Okay, what's the first part before 99?
The
T-H-E.
And then, yeah, and then 99, first numbers, spring.com.
And I'm sorry, could you repeat your email address? I missed part of it. Liz Butler, what?
D.C. as in District of Columbia.
Oh, Liz Butler.
So, LIZBUTLERDC at gmail.com.
I can be reached at MonicaZiot1982@gmail.com.
And then I'm actually going to run the other meeting this weekend. I'm totally amazing. And I'm going to hand over the reins to my colleague, Billy Wimstack.
Can I ask one thing? Or?
Yeah.
I was just trying to wait. I didn't want to change the conversation topic. But
yeah, that's fine.
My name is Tamara, and I'm calling from the Education Solution Network, which I think some of you are familiar with as a network of educators and activists across the country who are committed to justice in education that Dr. Carol Payne helped us start. One thing I wanted to offer or to suggest is that we maintain an online database
of social justice teaching material.
I'm not sure if it's me or you that's cutting in and out, but I'm only hearing every couple of words.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now any better, or is it still doing the same thing?
We hear you fine.
We hear you fine.
Oh, okay. So I'm from the Education for Liberation Network, and that we maintain an online database of social justice teaching materials that's free to search and materials to. And I was wondering if there might be materials related to the training process that would be generated, that people can use in their own communities, whether or not they are actually able to participate in this training, that we could share by the database. We'd be happy to make the database available as a resource to do that, because then, obviously allow people to search for those materials, whether or not they are necessarily familiar with the 99% Spring Project or whether they are able to participate in these trainings.
I think that's an excellent idea. The only problem with your idea is it wasn't mine. How do we make it happen?
Well, sorry, let me just repeat real quick because you can't interrupt in the conversation. I was saying that with the Education for Liberation Network, we maintain an online database of social justice materials called the EdLib Lab. It's free to search. It's free for people to post to. It's a way to try to aggregate all the fantastic, popular education workshops, social justice workshops, that people are developed so they can, constantly reinventing the wheel. And I was thinking there might be, through this training for trainers process, there might be materials that are generated from that we can help share not only with people who are participating, but people who are unable to participate, and that we'd be happy to, help support this effort by using the database in that manner if that would be useful. And it's a very easy process to connect materials to they can either be uploaded if people don't already have them on their website, or if they're already on a website, they can be linked, and we can label them so that if people just want to search things related to the 99% Spring, they can do that. So I would just need to maybe connect with somebody who, for the way you're asking about next steps, when or how it can be done. I don't know if there's somebody who's aggregating materials or what.
Send me an email and I will put you in touch with the right sort of people. We're also trying to figure out this for a whole range of follow-up materials and places that you can. We're being a lot of organizations that have already developed materials on a range of subjects.
Thank you, Ben, and by the way, Alice, we have a lot of curriculums for training people, so.
That would be great. And this way, so I'll definitely reach out to you about that, because we can try to. Make them searchable for the database.
Thank you so
much. Send me an email, and I can make sure that we're connecting on those fronts as well. We're looking for ways that we're going to help people see additional material online so that they have additional sources to go to and organizations to really develop even a 2.0 or 3.0 of many of the different subjects that we'll be touching on in the training.
Thank you very much.
Any other area
we should move in?
Thank you,
guys.
I'm going to turn this over to Billy. Billy, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Liz.
It's Liz Butler, cc@gmail.com.
Pastor Butler, what do you have there?
C as in dog and C as in cat.
@gmail.com. Okay.
Yes. And Billy can repeat that to you before he gets off the phone. He's very well aware of my email address.
Thank you so much.
And keep the questions going, because Billy has as much information on this as I do.
Any other areas to make this happen that should be raised right now?
This is Staunton in Youngstown. I would like to make two comments. The first is that having people like Dory and Diot as part of this project, it seems to me that even before you get to nonviolence, there's the question that Occupy, at least in Youngstown, I think in New York, and best I can gather everywhere is overwhelmingly white. And something has to be done about this, and it's not easy. And I think if there were any accumulated wisdom from SNCC's struggles with this, inviting hundreds of white volunteers, including myself, to Mississippi, and then some of those volunteers deciding to stay on, and all the things that we're all so familiar with, I think that might be even more important than nonviolence training for a first 5-day, 7-day experience. The second thing, probably much less important, is that this is an Institute for Policy Studies sponsored conference call or facilitated conference call. And I think that something IPS as IPS could contribute is if there were a summer school which offered training in some of the technical areas that not all, but many local Occupy groups are encountering. And I'm thinking of things like fracking in western Pennsylvania and Ohio and maybe elsewhere, foreclosures, what has been learned about the most helpful way to intervene in that process, et cetera, et cetera. I think anyone who knows me knows that I'm not against nonviolence training. I'm very much for it. But I think these two other areas, the hitherto all-white or mostly white character of the Occupy movement and the need for technical training in several specific areas, are additional challenges.
I'm very glad you had the courage to raise that. And my response to that is, if we do our work well, and if we're flexible, and if we deal with local people making decisions about what's happening in their area, we can have a direct impact on that. Because there's a sense of immediacy in the country that we may not be able to satisfy, but it is what drives us. And it is what drives making this kind of move successful. Yes, there needs to be a central place where we do specific kinds of training. And I'm in favor of dealing with both of those. I don't think there'd be any objection to anyone.
No, quite the contrary. The reason that the IPS offers me to set this up is because we are aware that so far most of the organizations who have signed up were predominantly white, though some of them are working in urban communities. So we are trying by outreach to the civil rights vets to begin to remedy that. And also, it's to say that if the 99% training is partly inspired by the legacy of Mississippi Summer, I mean, there's a similarity in the name, and we need to involve those people in order to contribute to them. So that's part of it. On the issue of the education, and I will pass it on to the IPS folks, but there is another component here that hasn't been spoken about, but that is on the 99 Spring website. There's also going to be training on that week of April 9th through 15th in what's being called economic literacy. Why is the spread between the wealthiest and the least wealthy? Why is that gap growing and not shrinking? And that is going to, I assume, Billy can tell us, get into the questions such as foreclosures, the responsibility of the banks, et cetera, et cetera. The idea of computing issues such as tracking is a great one. And again, what Eos said when he opened this meeting is, and what Liz has said when she spoke at the beginning, that this is to be a training in economics,
the history and then the practice of nonviolent direct actions specifically so that people can take on those pressing issues where they live and work. And for those in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where fracking is the kind of life or death issue, that ought to be done. But I like that idea of a summer institute, and I will talk to people here about that. Someone just say that?
The benefit intentional outreach done to Occupy the Hood, which is a group of mostly people of color. I mean, there are people involved that don't fall under the category of Occupy, but has there been any intentional outreach done to the leadership or the young leadership of Occupy the Hood to see what needs they have or why, or what is it that they're doing, how can we support that? I mean, I'm just wondering, did I hear anybody mention Occupy the Hood at all? Because that's a mostly people of color, youth-led group.
Well, let's put it this way. If they are associating themselves with this kind of activity, we want to be associated with them. It's not like they're doing something one way and we're going to do it another way. So, I mean, we need to know who do we get in contact with and let's meet them. I mean, this is about inclusion. This is about empowerment. And this is about flexibility.
Does he have contact information?
Did you hear that? Do you know how we can get in contact with him? Hello?
Serious organizers over here, sir.
You can get in contact with him.
Yes, sir.
Okay, please get in contact with them and forward your information either to Liz or to myself. Again, you can reach me.
Okay.
This is Billy. I just wanted to throw in a couple things. First off, if everyone can just say your name when you're speaking so everybody knows who's talking. I want to emphasize this has been pulled together super, super fast. And everyone who's doing this is doing it. I'm doing it on the side from, all my other full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of most people on the project. And so there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of things that are not what we want them to be on this project so far. And I want to emphasize, first of all, it's just an honor to be on this call, with all of you. I'm hearing names of my heroes, to me, this one training is just one little training, and what it's really about is, the bigger, longer-term movement and partnerships we can build in all kinds of ways. So I want to apologize in advance for any shortcoming that this one training might have, and let's make the best of it. But then let's also think and talk about, what comes after, what comes in the summer, what comes in the
As the oldest person on this call, let me say to you, when you're doing good work, never apologize for it.
Yeah, I'm the oldest person.
We'll settle that off.
I don't know. I
love it. Jim Marshall here.
But that conversation is over. The age question was over.
On the 22nd, there's a lecture called Living with Lynching for the African American Studies Department. And I'd like to take some of those students to the training that I go to on the 24th.
Excellent.
Because this is a way to get possibly a number of these students involved in, and these are students of color, getting them involved in what's going on. And I think this could be done in a lot of the universities around the country.
Getting
people in African American studies involved in what we're trying to do here.
I hope that you do that. I hope others will do similar activities. But let us be clear. If we maintain a program that is flexible, multifaceted, issue-generating, and locally determined, I think we can bring in a lot of people who have not previously been involved. We've got to go to them in their frame of reference, not in someone else's. Are you listening to me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay.
That's right. So just to add a couple other pieces of information, so just in terms of the logistics of finding events, organizing, you know, self-organizing events, training for events, all that, it's all on the website, organizations co-sponsoring, you know, so I hear about Education for Liberation Network, you know, when I hear about Bernard Lafayette's organization, you know, all of these organizations, you know, can co-sponsor and can get involved. And literally everything you need in order to plug in is on the website. There's forms to train, there's forms to organization. You just fill it out, and then, you know, folks will follow up with you to the listserv and get you plugged in different ways. And in terms of outreach, we need help. There are folks involved in, you know, in brotherhood who have been included in the process, I believe. I'm not actually, you know, directly the one who's been talking to them. But, you know, we need help. Just everyone you know, every listserv you're on, you know, if you just reach out, and I believe that everyone should make it their own, you know, at a local level, you know, take the curriculum and adapt it where it makes sense locally. Also, just want to let Don Lynn know that it's not a 7-day training, it's just a 7-day period when people will organize the training. So, you know, the training will either be 2 hours. Or it'll be 7 hours if people want to have long ones. But it's not a 7-day training, it's just a 1-day. And in terms of action, that's up to local groups to decide what action comes out of it. You know, so totally agree that, you know, that relationships, you know, among races and different backgrounds, you know, it's a key part of it. There's a big community building part of it. And also skill training. Because a lot of the people who are doing this, who are actually organizing, are doing action on foreclosure, are doing action on economic justice, and I know that's tied closely. And so some of that is built in, you know, depending on who the local organizers are, and it's going to be different than you think.
I love everything you said. This is about as many of us thinking as much of this as possible, but moving it forward.
Dory Latin speaking, we do know that young people have a lot of energy, and we're not as aged as we are. But I'm thinking about this age, some people are in high school at 18 years old. I just left high school, we are not still in high school. One young lady in the group was 18 years old. And if we could reach out to some of the younger groups who don't necessarily have to be in harm's way, get locked up for juvenile offenses like Dennis Trev did years ago, we could engage them. We don't necessarily have to focus on university students, but thinking about the energy and the areas that they could run and run for us. If that's
I think it's excellent. We've got to organize anyone who can be organized. From 5 years old. If you're 5 years old, you're going to be in class, you can start organizing. I'll excuse the 4.5-year-olds. No one else. And if you get old, Dan Jenkins, you still have a responsibility to organize.
Can I ask a follow-up question to the point that was made about the outreach? This is Tara speaking from the Education for Liberation Network.
Yes.
Is there a way to get e-flyers, like emails, by? Because I have this invitation to this phone call from the Connect Legacy Project.
Yes.
I'm actually from Madison Education
heritage related literary. And I haven't seen, that is the first I've heard of the Iron Arm Society, right? I haven't seen it.